okay, and let's say in receiver B, he's even noisier. It's not going to switch to receiver B, okay? If, let's say, he's equally noisy into both receivers, and his signal drops below the threshold of both receivers and then comes back up again, there's your hole.
Yeah, what you're describing is what I would call a picket fencing hole, and it has a very characteristic sound. There are times when I'm hearing a guy's audio, he is 95% audio, 5% sound, 5% noise, and yet switching is going on, and as he switches from channel A to channel B, I hear a definite dropout in between those switches. There are times when the switching phenomena...
Then explain to me why when I have the same amount of signal going into all three receivers and I switch between one and the other, you don't hear any hole.
If the signal-to-noise ratio is very high on two channels, is any switching required at all, Eric? Go ahead.
No, actually. Whomever is slightly stronger wins, but it stays there. It doesn't just let it go. It won't go from a higher signal of noise to a lower signal of noise backwards. Lower signal of noise to higher signal of noise. It'll only go, you know, in the reverse direction. But if you're in a moving vehicle, maybe A gets a little more than B does, but if both receivers are hearing it, it's not going to just blank out the transmission. You only get blanked out when neither receiver hears anything.
Now that we've got a missing channel that needs repair, does it aggravate the question? Does it aggravate the situation of what I'm calling dropout? Maybe I'm wrong, but it sounds like a dropout to me. Is that being aggravated by the missing channel, Eric?
Not in the sense of, now here it is. The receiver that is at Glen Oaks is the main receiver, alright? That's what's on pretty much most of the time. The receiver that's missing is the one on the hospital, which helps us out a lot in the South Shore, the southern part of Long Island, and Brooklyn, and that kind of stuff. The third receiver is out here in Plainview. And it has, it's a unity gain antenna, it's not up that high. It's the receiver of last resort, and it helps the folks out east, actually. You have a tendency to come through it more than. So, because there are areas where neither receiver is going to hit, you're going to get more dropout without the receiver in the middle that usually fills in the blank. Yeah, in that sense, yeah, the situation's aggravated. But if you ever really want to know what the receiver on Glen Oaks or any one of the receivers is doing, I can just simply make it stay there forever and you can see what happens. K2RWK, to reject.
Are you saying that you have the ability and you sometimes run that experiment of making it hang into
it? Do it more times than you're not even aware of it.
Okay, so the times that you force the non-voting when the signal in that particular channel is good enough, so to speak, because of... The voting does make some glitches, I presume. I mean, to make a voting change completely seamless is very difficult, isn't it, Eric?
No, I don't agree with that. Okay. Yeah. As far as your audio goes, it's seamless in terms of all of the input. The problem that we have is you may be in an area where both receivers are kind of struggling to hear you. That's the situation where it's going to pop back and forth, but it's not going to drop any audio. The only reason why you get a dropped audio is because neither receiver heard anything.
Okay. When a person's audio drops because of picket fencing, it has a particular characteristic sound. You do hear the signal-to-noise ratio instantaneously.
Right, but as the effect of the multiple receivers and switching back and forth, it changes the characteristic a little bit, you know.
Yes, it does. And there are times when I think it's switching between two noisy channels, and if it hung into one channel, I believe it would be a little bit more pleasant sounding, but that's just my impression. Okay, I thank you for that information. We've gone enough on that one. We're now going to go over to Wes's question, N2XJN, submitted to many of us this week, a article that was in QST Magazine. If you want to see the article that we're going to be discussing for the next couple of minutes, it is QST Magazine, the February 2008. It's an article by Kilo Delta 6, Juliet Delta Juliet. What he's talking about is a kind of antenna which has hemispheric coverage. Let me drop it. It's called the double cross antenna. Double cross, a NOAA satellite downlink antenna. In other words,
here's that from weather satellite.
Yes. So it's a weather satellite receiving antenna, and it has a strong relationship to something that's called a Lindenblatt array. If you look up of the 5,000 kinds of antennas, one of them is called Lindenblatt. What it really consists of is four individual dipoles. In the Lindenblatt, each of those dipoles are set off at a 45-degree angle compared to horizontal, compared to the plane of the Earth. This antenna recommends setting them off at 30 degrees instead of 45. Minor details. Let me drop them. But if you have four dipoles that are displaced, one of them is at 12 o'clock, top view, one is at 12 o'clock, one's at 3 o'clock, one's at 6 o'clock, and one's at 9 o'clock. And if you are walking around the perimeter of the total antenna, each one of those individual dipoles would look to you like it's tilted 30 degrees from being purely vertical. So when you're looking at the 6 o'clock antenna, you're standing a little bit outside of 6 o'clock, it is tilted 30 degrees to the right. You walk over so that you're looking at the 3 o'clock antenna, it's tilted 40 degrees to the right of being perpendicular, and so on. So all four antennas are displaced in that manner, and each antenna, if you're comparing the 3 o'clock antenna to the 9 o'clock antenna, they're almost at right angles to each other, and they're displaced by exactly a quarter wavelength in free space. Let me drop. So a pair of dipoles are crossed, are almost perfectly cross-polarized compared to each other, and the antenna is called double cross because you've got a pair of cross dipoles at 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock. You have another pair of cross dipoles at 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock. And now when you feed these correctly, this antenna gives you a coverage which is nearly ideal. The most ideal antenna pattern would cover the whole upper hemisphere of all the spatial objects you want to look at, like a weather satellite. And because the weather satellite that's straight overhead is closer to you, so you could get the most bang for the dollar, so to speak. Let me drop. You get the most bang for the dollar by having 12 decibels less gain at zenith, straight up, and all the gain is now a little bit more emphasized out to the horizon, and all 360 degrees of azimuth out to the horizon. That would be the most ideal antenna pattern. This particular antenna comes very close to that pattern. Instead of being 12 dB down, straight up, it's something more like a 6 or 8 dB down. Close enough. A very desirable antenna. In other words, when you're tracking a satellite, one possible way of tracking a satellite is to get as much gain in your antennas as you can muster, and now you've got an elaborate azimuth and elevation system that is tracking the satellite. Let me drop. That, in theory, is the most desirable antenna for a particular one single satellite where you know the satellite's Keplerian elements. In other words, you know all of the numbers telling you exactly where the satellite is going to be every instant in time, and your azimuth and elevation rotator system is doing that tracking for you. Or maybe it's a monopole system, which is electronically tracking. That is one very desirable. But if you want to keep it simple, if you can make an antenna like this antenna, which covers the whole hemisphere with a very desirable pattern, and no electronic or no mechanical switching or motion of any kind is required, this is a very desirable antenna. As long as those dipoles have enough gain, and you've got a low enough noise figure preamplifier connected to them, then this is a nice, simple receiving antenna that can do the job beautifully. Let me drop it. Now, in order to properly feed those dipoles, the article recommends that you set the 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock dipoles 0 degrees of phase shift between them. In other words, they're both being fed a signal in phase, but they're exactly a quarter wavelength apart. When you study in three-dimensional space, what that does, whether the signal you're receiving is coming from 12 o'clock or from 6 o'clock, in either case, the antenna will be clockwise, circular, polarized on receiving. And as long as your satellite is transmitting clockwise, circular, polarized wave, that's a very desirable setup, if you know what I mean. Nice and simple, but does the job beautifully. A little bit hard to believe that a pair of antennas, 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock, being fed in phase with each other, will generate circular polarization. And whether you look at them from 12 o'clock position or you look at them from the 6 o'clock position in azimuth, in either case, you'll see exactly clockwise circular polarization. Kind of hard to believe, but you go through the mathematics of that, take my word for it. The next thing you have to do is take the antennas at 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock and feed them 90 degrees different than the 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock antennas. So there's a 90 degree phase shift on the 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock antennas. And once again, it now makes beautiful circular polarization that literally walks around the perimeter of the antenna at the carrier rate. Does a beautiful job of making circular polarization everywhere, if you know what I mean. Both whether you're looking at the antenna straight down, whether you're looking at it from the horizon, or anything in between. A very desirable antenna. Let me drop it. Now, the article has a couple of errors. It talks about the difference of figure number 5 and figure number 6. And it talks about the difference of those patterns. Because of some kind of an editing error that occurred, figure number 5 and figure number 6, which are exactly alongside of each other, are the exact same diagram. The diagram got doubled. In other words, figure number 5, I think, is what's supposed to be there, and figure number 6 is a duplicate of figure number 5. So there's an error along those lines. Another error is that the phasing harness by which you feed the two signals at 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock 90 degrees later than the two signals at 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock, the diagram by which you do that has four pieces of 50-ohm cable going to those four dipoles, and if you simply put those four cables in parallel with each other, four 50-ohms divided by four would be 12.5-ohm impedance. It'd be a relatively difficult impedance to live with the usual way guys set it up. Let me drop it. What the article recommends is that you take the pair of antennas that are at, say, 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock, you don't put them in parallel, you put them in series. And the same thing with the pair of cables coming from 6 o'clock and 12 o'clock, you put them in series. How do you put them in series? You connect the two shields together, but do not ground them. The two shields are floating in space. You can't use ordinary connectors on a metal box to do this, and the article doesn't say that. So the two shields are floating, and now the two connectors, shield and center conductor, of your main coax cable going into this phasing harness, one of those goes to the center conductor of one of those two cables, the other goes to the other center conductor of the other cable. The two shields are connected together, the two shields are floating, and you're feeding the two center conductors. You are literally putting those two cables in series. A pair of 50-ohm cables in series gives you 100 ohms, so that's 100 ohms from your 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock dipoles. You also get 100 ohms from your 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock dipoles, and now you put 100 ohms parallel with 100 ohms, you get 50. It's a beautiful way of feeding the antennas, but the coax cables are hot and cannot be grounded. The article does not make that clear, and it should. The next thing the article does, let me drop it. Is it recommends you put a fairly large ferrite toroid, ferrite bead, let's call it, around the coax cable, very near each of the four dipoles. That ferrite bead up there near each one of the dipoles is a balance. It's got to be there because the dipole wants to be fed in a balanced manner. In other words, each dipole, at each instant of time, the right side of the dipole is positive, the left side is negative during this half cycle. But if one of those is connected to the shield and the other is connected to the center conductor, obviously you've got to have a hot shield. The only way you can have a hot shield without the shield of the cable becoming part of the resonant length of the dipole is you put a beautiful RF choke there. The ferrite bead acts like that RF choke. So it's a combination balance and isolation transformer, you could say, right at each individual dipole, indicating that each individual dipole is being fed correctly. Let me drop. But because the series arrangement of pairs of coax cables right at the bottom of the antenna, right where your feed line comes into this phasing harness, because they're fed in series, all of the shields of all four cables at that feed point have to be floating. As I said, the article does not make that clear. Once again, this is February 2008 QST Magazine, and the name of the article is The Double Cross and NOAA Satellite Downlink Antenna. Beautiful antenna, fairly easy to build, fairly high in performance, a little bit difficult to understand the theory of operation. They've even given you a beautiful antenna pattern that is a real measured antenna pattern as to the way this thing covers the whole upper hemisphere. So let me first go back to Wes, who brought this to our attention, a very nice article, and to XJN. How did you come across this particular article way back in 2008, the dark ages? I'm having some fun with Wes. Into XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I was lazy. I knew about this article for a long period of time, but I was lazy. Till one of the Polish ham radio operators put my attention to it. Now, I would love if you rephrase everything which you said, everything completely. Forget about the hot coaxial cable. We're never going to be hot. And again, rephrase the presence of the ferrite bed. If we only deal with the receiving antenna, this is receiving antenna. It is here.
Because of the law of reciprocity of antennas, whatever gain, pattern, efficiency, everything else you get on an antenna, whether you're using it in the transmit mode or the receiving mode, you get the exact same performance. So to say that it's only a receiving antenna, the only time that has meaning is that if some portion of the antenna is made out of components that are so small in diameter, like if I was using a ferrite loop strip antenna for transmitting, and if I was transmitting 50 milliwatts, no problem. But because it's wound with very fine grain, lit wire, and if I wanted to put 100 watts into it, no way, you would burn up a ferrite loop. So you might run into a power limitation of an antenna because of the components that you've used to make the antenna, because the ferrite rod is not big enough to tolerate a strong enough magnetic field, and the wire wound around it is too fine, yes, you might not be able to transmit into it. But if you go down to a lower power, and you measure the transmission efficiency and pattern and gain, and you now go over and measure the receiving efficiency, power, and gain, and effective capture area, everything will come out the same. So whenever somebody says it's only a receiving antenna, in this particular case, as long as you use a big enough chunk of ferrite in that toroid that's right at the individual dipoles, there's nothing stopping you from transmitting with this antenna. It could be used for an Oscar transmitting and receiving system. In fact, they give you the diameter, the dimensions for the antenna, if you want to use those particular frequencies on 2 meters 440 or the 135 megacycle frequencies for the weather satellite reception, I think, 137. So they give you the dimensions for 137 megacycles, 145 megacycles, and 435. They know darn well you're going to be using it for transmitting and receiving. Let me drop. But once you've put a large enough chunk of ferrite around the outside of a piece of coax cable, and if you look inside of one of these one-to-one balance that you can buy from Unidella and a whole bunch of other companies, if you actually look inside, there's a whole bunch of ferrite, usually iron-like material in a toroidal form, quite often stacked together around the outside of the coax cable. And why does that work? And I'm going to give you a couple of words on that. Whenever current flows through a conductor, you can point your thumb in the direction of the current flow, wrap your fingers around the wire, and now your fingers represent the lines of magnetic field around the piece of wire that happens because the current is flowing in the direction of your thumb. That's the right-hand rule. You could say it's a subset of Faraday's law. Every piece of wire of any length has inductance. The wire that we normally use for hookup circuits on our printed circuit boards, that kind of wire, a rough rule of thumb is that it has 22 nanohenries per inch. Every inch of wire that you use for hooking up of the circuits that you're drilling, that you're making, the inch of that wire, rough rule of thumb, has an inductance of 22 nanohenries at all the frequencies you're likely to use that piece of wire at. Let me drop it. And that's a given. The current flow through the wire is trying to make that magnetic field that I just showed you with my fingers wrapped around the wire. If I now put a piece of ferrite material around the wire, or around the coax cable, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if the conductor is larger diameter or smaller diameter. I put a piece of magnetic material around the outside of that wire, a ferrite bead, so to speak. A good piece of ferrite might have a mu rating of 1,000, a permeability of 1,000. That means the magnetic field in that toroid flows 1,000 times easier than it flows through air.
300 and 144.
I mean, my example, I'm using 1,000 in my example. And you could, if you want to, at low enough frequency, buy ferrite that has a permeability of 1,000. Some of them are lower than that, but the phenomena is still the same. Because the magnetic field that wants to flow around the wire can now do that inside of that toroid that you've placed there, and because the toroid has many times higher permeability than air, 100, 500, 1,000, because the magnetic field flows through there that many times easier. Go through the mathematics of Maxwell's equations on this one. I really should say it's Faraday's law. Once I've put magnetic material around the wire that allows the magnetic field to flow that many times faster, the number of nanohenries per inch goes up by approximately the same number. Instead of getting 22 nanohenries per inch, in my example, I can get 22 microhenries per inch, 1,000 times more inductance. If I can make the inductance of the wire high enough, because I've used a big enough chunk of iron around the wire, if the inductance is high enough, that's a fancy way of saying I've created an extremely good RF choke. The RF energy that's being launched down the outside of the coax cable, let me drop it. As the diode does its thing, whether it's receiving or transmitting, doesn't matter. As the diode does its thing, as I said, dipole. As the dipole antenna does its thing, a dipole antenna is a thoroughly symmetric antenna, and the laws of Mother Nature of how a dipole works, Mother Nature wants that to be a balanced structure. If you put +1 volt on the right-hand side of the dipole during this instant, Mother Nature wants there to be -1 volt on the left side of that dipole during that half of the sine wave. She wants it to be balanced. You can't launch a signal easily into a dipole and have all the voltage because you've connected the center conductor of your coax cable to the right-hand side. You think you're going to put all of the RF voltage on the right-hand side of that dipole and none on the left-hand side. You've got a problem it's very similar to the third law of Newton? Newton's third law, yes. Action and reaction. In the example that I've so often used, make believe that Arnold Schwarzenegger is holding on to a 200-pound barbell while he's floating in free space in the cargo hold of the space shuttle. A 200-pound man and a 200-pound barbell. When he pushes that barbell 1 meter per second to the north, his body, action and reaction, will move 1 meter per second to the south. You have to push against something. When you're launching current into the right-hand side of the dipole, you have to be taking current out of the left-hand side of the dipole. Action and reaction. The bottom line of all this is that whenever you think you're going to feed a dipole antenna with a piece of coax cable, and you think you're going to be having the center conductor going to only one side of the dipole, and that's the only side that's going to be hot, Mother Nature won't let you do that. Let me drop it. As you do that, the dipole antenna itself will launch current from the left-hand side into the coax cable outer shield. And if now, by way of this ferrite bead, you create enough inductance so that it starts looking like an RF choke, it looks like an open circuit at your operating frequency, even though you have launched current into the shield, it goes down as far as a piece of ferrite, and the current stops. It doesn't go any further. If you've created enough reductance, enough of an artichoke there, and you can do it as a poor man's balance by putting the right number of turns at the right diameter of the coax cable in that area, held together with black tape, so to speak. But the ferrite technique is a much more sophisticated way of doing it. So now you're launching current only during the first inch of that cable until you get down to that ferrite, and now because that's an artichoke, the current will not flow any further. Therefore, the cable is not becoming hot because of the dipole, and therefore the cable being connected to the dipole is not electronically connected to it, and it's not detuning the dipole. Still, you do have hot cable down at the bottom because of the series feeding technique. Nowhere near as much, but you can't ground those connectors to a metal box at that 4-to-1 feeding arrangement where the pairs of cables are in series. Very sophisticated antenna. A lot more words are required. Let me drop. To properly use this antenna, to properly build this antenna, to make it work well, the article really needed some more words. There's a lot of missing information here. A person who is very skilled at building a Lindenblatt antenna would know all this. But the average reader of that article, I guarantee a certain number of people built that article and could have been unhappy with the results because of some of these fine details. Still a darn nice article, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN. So, the antenna could work without the ferrite at all as a receiving antenna, true or false? One thing. The second thing. Dr. Roy was postulating that this looks like a good approximation for an isotropic radiator. We'll be talking about my question was about the ferrite. So, he assumed that the ferrites are included in phasing harness to act as an RF choke and limit common mode transmission back into the shock. And I put a doubt to it because the common mode signals defined would be radiated signals coupled equally to the both lines and opted from the signal common created in the driver circuit or a ground differential between the transmitting and the receiving locations. That's a typical universal common mode defined. And the doubt was double cross antenna doesn't have any transition signal, so there is no transmission. This is the receiver antenna, and there is no radiator signal present. So could you address those two things together? And Tracy?
Your question was, would it work if you leave out those chunks of ferrite?
If you just have no ferrite, it should work as a receiving antenna.
Whether you use it as a receiving antenna or a transmitting antenna does not matter. If you leave out the ferrite, will it stop working? No. Will it work as well? No. I mean, if I normally fish with 50-pound test fishing line, and I go fishing and I'm picking up 20-pound fishes, and somebody says, no, I'm not going to allow you to use anything but 4-pound test fishing line, does that mean I can no longer go fishing? Of course not. I'm not going to be as happy. I'm going to lose a lot of fish, but I can still go fishing. This antenna will be lower in performance. And I can tell you in which manner it will be lower in performance, but it will be lower in performance if you leave out those chunks of ferrite. Is it still going to work as a transmitting antenna or as a receiving antenna? Yes. It's just not going to work as well. I'm not quite sure I understand the second question you were asking. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Thank you very much. All ferrites. How much approximately based on your estimate the antenna would work worse, and what are the factors that you think would be worse if the beta not present?
If you lead up the ferrite, now the length of the outer conductor of the coax cables feeding each of the four dipoles becomes electronically coupled to the antenna. It will detune in the individual dipoles. You've now added extra reactive components to the left-hand side of each one of those dipoles, so to speak. They will give you a higher standing wave ratio. On top of that, the phase shift you're creating is such that circular polarization will not be as pure. You're now going to generate a higher axial ratio. The quality of circular polarization is called axial ratio. You're going to generate a higher axial ratio at a higher standing wave ratio if you leave out those chunks of fairway. It doesn't mean you're dead in the water. It's still an antenna. You're still going to hear signals. The pattern is not going to be as clean. The circular polarization is not going to be as good. The signal-to-noise ratio is going to degrade because of pattern degradation and axial ratio degradation, because the satellite you want to listen to is transmitting a circular signal, and if your antenna is now elliptical in polarization and not circular, you're going to get a smaller percentage of that signal. You're going to suffer, oh, maybe the answer is only losing 1 or 2 dB of signal-to-noise ratio, but the signal itself is kind of weak, particularly when the satellite is on the horizon, and you'd rather not do that because you've left out a dollar's worth of material, if you know what I mean. Maybe it's $4 for the four ferrites you should be putting there. Over to you, Wes, K2LIW. The guy who designed the antenna put them there for a good reason. He didn't do it because he's selling ferrites.
I'm saying that I don't accept your explanation. I'm going deep into the subject I understand fully. You have a typical sensitivity of input of the receiver, 100 of an of the micro volt. Okay, so we have a 10 nanovolts, 100 nanovolts of the signal. How much of the reactive response 100 of nanovolts, 10 nanovolts could create? So there's a significant difference of bits being there or not. And to experience.
I think I know what you're asking, but I'm going to answer it a different way. If the ferrite is doing its job and gives you a really desirable RF choke on a 50 ohm cable, I would like the RF choking function to be high in impedance compared to 50 ohms. So if the RF choking function is now 500 or 1,000 ohms, only 1% of the energy being initiated into the outer shield of the coax cable at the dipole, only 1% of it will propagate beyond that ferrite. So you're trying to make an RF choke that's high in impedance compared to the characteristic impedance of the cable, 10 to 1 or 100 to 1 higher, and you're in like Flynn when you do that. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you for that explanation. Still, the number is astronomically small, I would say. Definitely, I believe you're right. But to be able to see the difference, kind of hard. Do you agree with that?
I think I can see what you're doing as an analysis, and you've fallen into a trap. If the signal I'm listening to is supposed to be 1 microvolt, if my antenna is working well, and that satellite is 400 miles away from me, and is transmitting a certain amount of effective radiated power, and I'm supposed to get a microvolt signal.
At this 1 microvolt is the sensitivity of the receiver from 1950, and this is the sensitivity of the regular AM receiver. So we're talking the signal is, say, 10 nanovolts. Now you continue.
Had you let me keep talking, I would have told you whether a 1 microvolt or a 10 microvolt signal is supposed to be received. And because you've done something wrong and you've lost 6 dB. You've lost 6 dB of the effective performance of the antenna. Instead of getting 1 microvolt, you're going to get half a microvolt. Instead of getting 10 microvolts, you're going to get 5 microvolts. When you lose 6 dB of performance of an antenna, whatever voltage you used to get, you're going to get half that voltage. Whether the signal is a microvolt or 40 volts, you're going to get half the voltage when you go down by 6 dB. It doesn't matter if you're transmitting or receiving. It doesn't matter if the signal is weak or strong. You're going to get half the voltage if you lose 6 dB of antenna performance. So the fact that the signal starts are very weak and you can no longer see a small change doesn't matter. The signal-to-noise ratio is going to go down by 6 dB. 2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is a perfect response because whatever I do, important factor is signal to noise ratio. And if the noise floor is significant comparing to the signal strength, yes, everything that I could do to have a performance of antenna better is important. That's why most of the amplifiers are next to the antenna, not next to the end of the coaxial cable. Interesting.
Now, are you asking a set of questions because you want to understand what the ferrite bead is doing, or because you want to save money and time and you don't want to put the ferrite bead there? What's the reason you're asking this question? I'm going to guess it's because you want to have a further understanding of what it's doing and why it's there. Is that true, Wes? K2RIW?
The course and the effort is for me not important. Interesting.
Okay, you said something is not important. Doesn't matter what it is. So, if you decide to change the design of the antenna by leaving out some of those components, you're probably going to pay a price, and now you make the decision. You pay your money and you take your choice, if you know what I mean. Each of those components in that antenna are there for a good reason. I wouldn't eliminate them unless you've got an awful lot of understanding of what you're doing instead and you're making some other compensation. I wouldn't recommend that. Okay, that's a nice antenna. And do you intend to build one of those, or have you already built one of those, Wes? Go ahead.
I have.
Wes first, and then Eric in that order. N2XJN, have you already built one of these, Wes? K2RIW in the TechNet?
I did not. But I believe that everything that you say, and I'm putting out from you, is for benefit of all of us. And I do very much thank you for that lecture. Eric, pick up.
Yeah, how long ago did you build one of these? What did you do with it, Eric? And were you happy with its performance? Did it seem to give you a beautiful low axial ratio circular polarization across the whole hemisphere? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K3J. I guess it was about 20 years ago I picked up a Vanguard weather receiver. The antenna is actually cut to 136 megs. Built it out of PVC pipe. And, all the noise comes through real well from horizon to horizon. Doesn't matter, you know. The path that these satellites take basically to scan the Earth, literally. So, you know, in the next pass around, they come from a different point on the horizon. Once the signal hits the receiver, that's it, you know. You get APT pictures out of it. Eventually I got bored of that and built a 1691 down converter and used that so that way you can get the high-res pictures. K2RW, K2J.
What's awful nice about this antenna is that assuming the satellite you're listening to is strong enough, I don't know the exact gain this antenna gives you, but maybe it's 5 dB of gain over isotropic. As long as you're getting enough signal and you don't have to aim the antenna, you don't have to electronically switch it, you don't have to do anything. You just continuously keep watching the signal from that satellite, horizon to horizon. And whether the signal's on the horizon or straight overhead, the antenna keeps right on cranking because it's covering the whole hemisphere. And as, let me think, who was it that gave that information to him? As Roy, AC2GS, and Wes had a discussion. This antenna does come very close to performing the nearly impossible thing called isotropic antenna. To make a truly isotropic antenna, an antenna that behaves like a incandescent white light bulb in the middle of a spherical room. Let me drop. That spherical white incandescent light bulb in the middle of a spherical room. If it's a 100 watt light bulb, and the room has an internal area of 100 square meters, then pretty much by definition, each square meter is going to be getting 1 watt of energy out of that light bulb. That's an isotropic antenna. There's a catch. That isotropic antenna as a light bulb is not coherent. It's radiating a whole lot of frequencies at once, a whole lot of phase angles at once. It has no distinct polarization, no distinct frequency. You now try to generate a real RF energy from a signal generator, into an antenna that you call isotropic, and you want the antenna to fill up a whole sphere or a hemisphere with equal amount of energy going everywhere at some defined polarization. That's a very difficult requirement. This antenna comes close. Still has a notch of 60 feet or so straight up, which is desirable when it comes to satellite reception, but it's not isotropic. But it comes close. It's one of the closest antennas that you can build that's isotropic, but there's a whole bunch of rules of physics that will stop you from making a truly isotropic RF coherent antenna. It's almost a conflict in terms. Let me drop it. Yet all of our formulas for measuring antenna gain, particularly at microwave frequencies, every microwave antenna, the manufacturer usually will tell you its gain in decibels above isotropic, because the theoretical isotropic antenna is the lowest gain antenna you can build. It has zero directivity, no directivity at all. It sends out the signal, radiates the signal in all directions like a light bulb, in theory. Mathematically, an isotropic antenna is easy to handle. And telling you gain above isotropic is a nice number that you can mathematically handle. But to really build one, to really do a test on an antenna range, you got a problem. You'll start comparing it to some other antenna whose gain, you know, a so-called standard gain feed horn is what they usually use. The next person on the list was K2 Mike Uniform, Bernie. And Bernie lives in Bayside. If we haven't put Bernie to sleep, are you still with us? Go right ahead with your question, Bernie. K2 Mike Uniform, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I heard a beep there. This is Bernie, K2MU. And I have a question about the, somebody mentioned the Yosu SDR radio, software-defined radio. Eric, I heard you out there. I want to thank you for your suggestion. The problem is with the driver of the thing. I did get it to operate. It turns out you have to download something called Zadig, and here's the secret. Put that Zadig program in the SDR Sharp file to run the software-defined radio. But specifically, my question is, I got the driver to work, and I'm picking up VHF, fine, but HF is dead. So I don't know if there's another driver for HF. There was somebody on the TechNet, I think a couple of weeks ago, had mentioned that Yosu, that had the HF chip in there as well. So if anybody out there knows what I got to do to get HF to work for the SDR radio, SDR RTL chip, Yosu, back to you, Dick.
Now, here I'm not completely familiar with Bernie. Yaesu is a popular brand name of ham radio equipment. The SDR radio you're talking about, is it a Yaesu brand name, or is it really something in SDR world called Yaesu? Over to you, Bernie, K2LIW.
Yeah, it's Y-O-S-O-O. And what it is it's when you do those SDR radio chips, it skips the HF band. So there's some manufacturers. There was somebody on the TechNet a couple of weeks ago that was talking about playing around with this SDR radio, and I bought the same one. He described the picture on the front. It's like a little cigarette pack size. Excuse me. It has two chips in it. Another one is for HF. So I know Eric had some information on that, and I just thought I would pop on. Maybe the gentleman who was playing with the radio knows, or somebody else knows, if there's some special other thing you got to do to get the HF section to work. That's really why I got it. A little disappointed I'm not picking up HF. So, yeah, it's Yankee Oscar, Sierra Oscar Oscar. It's about a $50, $60 SDR radio on Amazon.
Let's see if Eric is with us. KE2EJ, K2RW, are you with us, Eric? Okay, anyone else have any knowledge of the Yaesu software-defined radio that can give us any further information that Bernie is asking for? Anyone else with any information on that, please give me your call letters right now, K2RW. Is it a radio with that chip inside that's doing the software-defined radio function? Give us a few more words, and I think you said it was 50-some-odd dollars. Does it come with its own printed circuit board, so to speak, and you apply B-plus and connect it to the rest of the IF strip-over receiver? How do you actually use this thing, Bernie? K2 Mike Uniform, K2LAW in the TechNet.
I didn't hear the beep, but okay. Yeah, it's a dongle. What it is RTL SDR dongle. It's the one that was used for silver seeds or something like that. They'll get them real cheap for like $15 or $12 even. And you just plug them into the USB. It's been around for a bunch of years now, I think. There's a free SDR radio software, SDR Sharp. Go to SDRSharp.com and you can get the software. So you get the $12 dongle, and you get software, and you're playing SDR radio, which I have done in the past, and I also had a driver problem then too, but it was easier at all if you needed that extra driver to get that thing to work properly. But in order to get that dongle, that the ubiquitous $12 dongle to work on HF, there's another, I don't know if it's a dongle, I guess there's another piece that has to be connected to it. And so some companies, some people are packaging them in a little box. That way you have the whole RF spectrum pretty much without having to buy anything else. So that's the difference this time. I got this little thing. It's like smaller than your iPhone, little metal box, and it has the dongle and that other piece that extends into the HF band. Back to you.
Yeah, I'd like you to check in with us periodically, Bernie, and tell us how this project is going. When it comes to digital dongle-like things, some of the experts on this repeater that know a lot about that subject, Eric, KE2EJ, Lou, NY2H, over the last year and a half, he has bought a whole lot of dongle-like things to set up a whole bunch of radios for the so-called Green Sky Project, by which he's monitoring what's going on the band. Bernie, K2 Yankee Oscar, Rich, N2 PPN, let's see, KD2YHY, I think it is, can't think of his call letters right now, but some of the guys you're looking for, K2YO, NY2H, KE2EJ, and there's probably a couple more, N2 PPN, those particular guys. I'd like to believe they're going to be able to help you, and maybe they're already familiar with that function. It looks like I hung in here a little bit too long tonight, and those guys are not around at this time. We might not be able to help you tonight, Bernie. I think you stumped us. K2 Mike Uniform, drag your feet in case somebody comes along and has got some knowledge on this. Yowasso, Y-O-S-S-O, software-defined radio chip. So drag your feet as we pass it back to you. K2 Mike Uniform, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2YDT, query.
KC2YDT, K2RIW. Go ahead, Matt.
Okay, I just turned the radio on, came in late. I heard you say dongle. By any chance, are you talking about the dongle for DMR Plus?
There's a chance that that's what we're talking about. Bernie, K2 Mike Uniform, brought us this question. So make believe you're starting off from fresh, and Matt just joined us, and tell us whatever you know about your device and the fact that it's receiving VHF frequencies but won't receive HF frequencies. Go right ahead, Bernie. K2MU. Fill Matt in, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Matt and Dick, very fine. I don't think it's GMR Plus. This is the RTL SDR dongle, and it's a little package that has the additional piece required for HF coverage. And that's okay, Dick. You know, I know this is very particular. The thing doesn't come with instructions. And I wouldn't have bothered the TechNet with this question if I hadn't tried Googling and YouTubing and trying everything I could to find the answer. I was hoping that the gentleman who mentioned this unit, it was probably 2 weeks ago. You know, I listen, I'm a regular listener, I don't check in. I'm one of the many listeners who doesn't check in. And he mentioned this little unit. YOSOO. So it's a full radio spectrum from, you know, you name it, from like a couple of hertz to what, you know, all the way up to a few gigahertz. But mine is not playing HF now, and I'll just have to live with that for now. Back to you, Dick, K2MU.
Matt, do you have possibly any information that can help Bernie? KC2YDT, K2RIW, the tech now.
Okay, I know we had a conversation on this frequency a while about a dongle. Does that station have any idea who that station was that was mentioning it? By any chance, was it TJ, K2LIE, or Mike, K2DUT?
Yeah, Bernie, do you remember who it was that mentioned this to you? Go right ahead, Bernie. K2MU, K2LIW.
No, I wish I did. But it was somebody on the TechNet 2 weeks ago. I'm pretty sure. Pretty sure it was 2 weeks ago because I just ordered it about a week ago. And he described the reason I was able to order the same one was he described the design on the box. It kind of looks like a skyline. Described it very well and on Amazon and the price and all of that. So I don't remember who it was. I guess he's not on now or he'd pop on and we have the answer. But yeah, there was a discussion about SDR radios about 2 weeks ago.
Let's hope you eventually run into that guy again. But because there are people on this repeater that are quite savvy on digital and SDR radios, okay, I'm going to make a guess. One of the guys could have been Rich, K2 UPS. Does that sound right? K2 Uniform Papa Sierra. He has been doing a lot of work with software-defined radios and portable operations these days. He's the guy who works for the UPS company. And quite often when he checks into the TechNet, he's on the road in Pennsylvania or in Ohio. Does that ring any bells? Is that possibly the guy you're talking about, Bernie? K2 Mike Uniform, K2RIW?
K2 MM1.
MM1, maybe he knows. Go ahead, Ray.
I don't know for sure, but I got a good idea. It was probably ELW2MPG. He's always doing that stuff. And if the gentleman wants to find out, if he waits until the computer net, I'm sure whoever it was will be on the computer net to answer it. I also hooked up that dongle. It works well, but it doesn't work on HF, and I didn't know there was another piece that was interesting to get. So, okay, KC2MM1.
Okay, KC2MM1. It looks like you've got a similar problem. You and Bernie are together on this one. So you're eventually going to solve it. And, any of those call letters ring any bell, Bernie? K2MU, K2RIW?
I didn't hear the beep. I don't know what's going on if the beep's not coming over EchoLink because I'm kind of monitoring here. But, no, it definitely wasn't K2UPS. I know, Rich, we've spoken, and I would remember the call. No, it wasn't. It may have been the call that the fellow just mentioned, Neil. It's somebody's call I didn't really recognize. He sounded like a local, sounded like somebody who lives around like Long Island or something. Yeah, I wish I remember his call, but it could be. The other gentleman could be right. And yeah, mine is the dongle. It's two pieces in one. So before I open it up to see if everything is, well, the connections are still intact and I and break some while I'm doing it. If I find out if I'm doing something wrong with software, which I think may be, you know. This driver stuff isn't as much fun as soldering, I'll tell you that, but whatever. Thanks a lot, Dick. I really appreciate the effort. This is K2MU.
Western and 1YDY. YDY, go right ahead.
Hey, Bernie, are you talking about, you know, this device that's got a couple of RF inputs on the top to view the Yasu full band 100 kHz to 1.7 GHz SDR USB tuner?
Yes, that's the one.
Just found it on Amazon. I'm just trying to figure out what we're talking about. So thank you very much.
So what you found so far, Hank? Any chance that it's going to answer Bernie's question? Or what you found is that just selling the device without giving you information? What's your guess on this one, Hank? N1YDY, K2RAW.
So far, I just have a bunch of questions, but I see that it's offered by at least three vendors, and I thought I would start Googling the vendors and see what they had to offer.
For the time being, Bernie, you've stumped us. Not sure we can help you, but progress is being made. You're eventually going to find somebody that's got the answers. And you haven't made a huge investment so far, you haven't been stung as I see it. And you're eventually going to get to the bottom of this. And when you do, please come back and tell us what you find out. Any finals, Bernie? K2 Mike Uniform, K2RAW.
Oh, yeah, well, listen, Dick, I was really hoping just that gentleman who turned me on to the unit, who had mentioned it, was down to check that tonight. I know this isn't a typical, radio theory type question, but I'll tell you, there's something to the software-defined radio, the little dongle, it's just, you've got to experience it, you know, what it's like to play digital radio, software-defined radio, as much as I love the regular stuff, but this is really a fun experience. And I know that sooner or later we'll get it to work. Persistence are these problems. So, once again, thanks, and I really enjoy the tech net. Back to you.
Hang in there, Bernie. It looks like Ray, KC2MMY, has the exact same problem you do. And Ray thinks that Nick, N2MEG, Mike Echo Golf, has some further information on it. With a great delay of an extra hour and 10 or 12 minutes, we have got to go over to the mailbag, but some of the stuff we were finding out about synod measurements of FM deviation, the stuff was too good to interrupt as I see it, John. KC2MMG, the man with the mailbag. Have you got any tough ones this week, John? K2LIW and the tech man?
No, Dick, I think these are all easy. By the way, I think Rich had a question, N2EO.
Oh, I forgot about him. Rich, N2 Echo Oscar. The microwave voice of Massapequa, K2LIW. Go ahead, Rich. Hope we haven't put you to sleep.
KC6LSP.
I think I'm hearing KC6LSP. Because it sounds like KC6LSP. Lima Sierra Papa, if that's who it is. K2RIW. My name is Zick. Go right ahead.
KC6 Lincoln Frank Paul. Lima Foxtrot Papa. Echolink. I just happen to hear, I'm up at Cape Cod, and I happen to hear you on the, I think it was the W2 Cape repeater, which I can't get into. Does this net go every Sunday, 9, 10 p.m.?
Yes, it does. This net is every single Sunday for the last 33 years. Started in 1982. Starts at 8 o'clock every Sunday. And nowadays it goes until midnight throughout most of those years. So this net has been around. This is the Long Island Technical Net. K2RIW is the net control guy. His name is Dick, and you're talking to him right now. And so, the people who sign in at 8 o'clock, for the first hour or so, we take them in order with their questions. And so you're beyond the sign-in period right now, but hopefully you'll be back next week. KC6, Lima Foxtrot Papa, for any other comments? K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
I appreciate it very much. I had to do a little research here in the last half hour to find the W2 KC2 repeater that I can hear up here, but I can't hit it. So I finally found an Echo Link. Anybody gets it, the W2 Yell repeater. I appreciate the information. I'll let you get back to your net. And very interesting, by the way. I just happen to hear you because you're the same frequency as the Falmouth Amateur Radio Association.